Sign in, Len.
I should.
Sign in. Don't get to sneak in. Okay. That's like an even bell. Let's get organized. So welcome or welcome back. It's been far too long, actually. But it gave me the time to actually prepare, so that's good. Before I kind of tell you what's up and coming, I thought that I'd kind of charge right into the first segment of the class that we do, which is a meditation segment. The particular kind of meditation that I talk about is mindfulness, but you can do any kind of meditation you like in this first little segment of class. Typically, we meditate for 10 minutes when we first come in. But I usually introduce that with a little bit of information, and I'm going to do that right now. Thanks to Tim Gill. Where's Tim Gill? Yeah, I got to know that in the New York Times Magazine this week, there was an article on mindfulness. And it mentioned, I read the article and I wanted to mention just a few of the findings that it mentioned itself. A few of the findings that were in the article. This is Amishi Jha, who was a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, who traveled to Hawaii to train United States Marines in post-traumatic resilience rather than post-traumatic stress. And this is a quote from her. "We found that getting as little as 12 minutes of meditation practice a day helped the Marines to keep their attention and working memory. If they practiced less than 12 minutes or not at all, they degraded in their functioning under the stress of combat." So that's one study. And it has to do, again, with attention and working memory. Working memory is keeping stuff in your mind long enough to kind of use it. It's working memory is a failure of working memory is when you walk into the kitchen and go, "What did I come in here for?" Where are we? What day is tonight? Let's see. Another study that showed that in the anterior cingulate cortex, the white matter was enhanced. White matter functioning was enhanced by mindfulness. White matter is the axons that connect neurons. And the anterior cingulate cortex has to do with decision-making and problem-solving. So being mindful seems to help decision-making and problem-solving. Another study, undergraduates instructed to spend a mere 10 minutes a day for 2 weeks. That's not very much meditation practice. 10 minutes a day for 2 weeks. Practicing mindfulness made a significant improvement on the verbal portion of the graduate record exam, a gain of 16 percentile points. They also significantly increased their working memory capacity, which is the ability to maintain and manipulate multiple items of attention. Work on stuff and keep stuff in your mind, rather than get distracted. It trains the mind to stay on task and avoid distraction. One more comment from this article, and that's what I'll go to in a minute. For some people who begin mindfulness training, I would add, for everybody who begins mindfulness training, it's the first time in their life when they realize that a thought or emotion is not their only reality. If they have the ability to stay focused on something else, for instance, their breathing, and let that thought or emotion just pass by. Those of you who have been doing mindfulness for a while, it's easy in theory, not quite so easy in practice, but that's the idea. One more little site for you, which is, this is from the current American Psychological Association Monitor, which is the magazine that goes out to everybody who's associated with the American Psychological Association. Mindfulness training appears to improve attention skills and lower antisocial behavior amongst incarcerated youth. 16 to 18 year olds in jail, the stress of being in jail causes them to function less well cognitively and have less self-control, except if they have been taught mindfulness. Attention-related task performance for most of the participants decline due to the stress of being incarcerated. The mindfulness group showed significantly less of a decline compared with the control group. In addition, the teens who practiced mindfulness outside of the intervention sessions, that is, they went to their cells and practiced mindfulness, showed no decline at all in attention and cognitive control. Cognitive control means, you know, when you get angry, you don't yell. So just a few of the so many studies that are pouring in about the benefits of something so simple that we should learn it when we were four. So let's learn it a little bit. For people who have seen this diagram ad nauseum, ad nauseum, ad nauseum, I just got to get everybody up to speed because there are some folks that haven't been in the class or heard this before. So this is the simplest of the diagrams. I have lots of other ones I've been doodling. So two sets of instructions. Instructions for beginners and instructions for advanced beginners. Okay? Instruction for beginners. When we sit in the 10 minutes we're going to sit, your job is to just bring your attention to your breathing. And every time your attention leaves your breathing, bring your attention back to your breathing when you realize that you're lost in thought about your breathing or dinner or anything else. Everything else that you experience is normal. Boredom is normal. Confusion is normal. Being lost in thought for the entire 10 minutes and going, oh my God, I should have been paying attention to my breathing, was normal. What you're doing is you're training your attention to go where you put it and to stay there, which is, believe it or not, something that we don't know how to do very well. So beginning instruction, just bring your attention back to your breathing. I point here because for most of us, the belly rising and falling is the most pronounced part of the breathing and the easiest to pay attention to, and the furthest from the head, which seduces you into thought. So keep bringing your attention to your breathing. That's all you need to practice at this point. Everything will evolve from there. So you're just going to sit, you're going to find your breathing, you're going to get lost in thought, you're going to come back to your breathing, you get lost in thought, and you do that for the rest of your life. What changes is the percentage of the time that you're lost in thought versus staying with your breathing. Second, more advanced instruction. Open yourself on every level. Open your thoughts so they can flow freely. Open your feelings so they can flow freely. Open your senses so that they're vivid. So open your soul, you know. Open everything on every level. And at the same time, be aware of everything that's happening. That is, witness it all. That's a simple instruction, right? Let yourself become progressively and more completely open, and at the same time, stay absolutely present with your experience. And if you do that well, teach the class. one last thing before we sit, which is... I find the fact that mindfulness is finding its way everywhere in the culture to be an incredibly encouraging thing. Because what it signals is the opportunity for humanity to not be automatically motivated by our genes and by our instinctual urges, and also by the trauma that we have experienced in growing up. That is, we can experience our biological and psychological nature without being governed by those things. We have the possibility of evolving as a species to be more, to have more flexibility in our choice and flexibility in our behavior. And so I think that the wildfire explosion of mindfulness into the general culture is both astounding to me, and also is probably a response to the fact that humanity better evolve pretty quickly if we're going to stick around this little sphere that we're on. All right, so also another, for those of you who are kind of practiced at this, if you keep your eyes closed, the inner world comes more into focus. If you keep your eyes open and look down, you stay more present in the outer world. I think that it's good to experiment with both eyes closed and eyes open. With eyes closed, you have a tendency to be able to let go better, to open up better. With eyes open, you have a tendency to stay present more. It would be nice to be able to be present walking around in your life and still be relaxed. So try eyes open and eyes closed. We'll sit for 10 minutes, and then we'll charge into the lesson for today. Way to look at mindfulness is it's a process in each sitting and over many sittings of discovering levels of contraction or tension or distress. For a while, not being able to open those things, or to allow those things to open. But after a while, sometimes swiftly, sometimes not so swiftly, you're able to let go of that contraction and soften it and open it. And that's a relief and a deepening of who you are. And then there's another level that appears. And so it's a progression of discovering and releasing contraction. And that happens as you sit again each time. You realize, oh, I'm worried about this, or I'm tight here, or I'm tight here. And you kind of work with it and feel it and create space around it. It opens up. And then you feel better. And then there's something else. You know, and so there's a gradual, in each sitting and over many sittings, progression toward being more spacious and open, less preoccupied and determined. And it seems to be necessary to be aware of this process happening. If you go to sleep, sometimes you can open up pretty well, although there's only certain levels of opening that happen when you sleep. When you get up again, the closenesses reassert themselves. It seems to be important to be conscious of the process of release. So you need to stay conscious as you do this. And being aware of your breathing keeps you from getting lost in things and also from getting going unconscious. So the whole process of becoming more mindful or more generally of psycho-spiritual healing and growth is a process of opening and staying aware or increasing awareness. So two things are happening. One is your self-definition is expanding, ultimately to a unity, and your awareness is deepening so that you're not acting unconsciously anymore. So that's what we're practicing in this very simple, progressive way. All right, but that's not what I wanted to talk to you about. That's preamble. We'll look at mindfulness and meditation more generally week after week. First of all, how's it feel in here versus room 31? Do you like it? It feels like these are pretty comfortable chairs, and it's brighter, and there's a little bit more breathing room. So if the media work okay, I think we did all right. Now, I made a lot of conditions for moving us in here. One of the conditions was they were going to have tables for us.
Why?
Because we need to write sometimes. And also because it gives you more personal space. If you're all jammed up together, you don't have so much space. So in terms of the personal space thing, today, don't move your chairs too much because they've got a self-esteem lecture coming in here at noon. But in weeks thereafter, if you don't like being jammed up, move your chairs around. You know, they're just going to have to fold them up anyway. So make space for yourself here. In terms of tables, there's probably not enough room for the tables, A. And B, I talked to the guys that do we were in here last week and we were looking at this and figuring out, they would have to take 30 big tables from somewhere, they don't even have 30, and bring them in here and schlep them out again to the classroom, and that's what all to happen in half an hour before the class. And I kind of thought, you know...
It's not moving.
No, this is
it's more fine.
All right. It lets us be closer to you. Yeah.
All right, so what that means is, for next week especially, you need to bring something to write on. A clipboard or a big book. I will give you the paper. But you need a writing implement and you need something to write on. Because next week's class, the entire class, it's all one contiguous thing. There's going to be no meditation at the beginning. Meditation's part of the class. I'm going to lead you through something next week. And you'll need to have writing ability.
But we're not
going to
be turning in anything.
No, you're not going to be turning in anything. For free. You can't use an electronic device to do this because you're going to need to actually color some stuff in. Okay. You're going to be actually kind of coloring on something. Just with a pen or pencil. Okay. Carl.
Consider just getting a couple of tables for people that might need that kind of support. I mean, so many of us can write on a notebook or something, but a couple extra tables, you can put a few chairs and two tables.
If somebody needs that, let me know and I will order that. I won't order that unless somebody says, please get me a table, in which case we'll put the tables in the back. But so if anybody needs that, let me know, I can get that order. So let me tell you what's happening in the next three classes. I have a whole thing today. but quickly, the next three classes. I have more than enough material for the whole term and next term too, so I haven't decided what's going to go where toward the end of this term. But the next three classes are fixed, set in stone. Okay. Next week, we're going to do an experience. I think a pretty important experience. We'll see. Some of you have done this with me before. If you have, doing it again will be A, revelatory, and B, you'll be able to compare your results from before with your results now to see what the consistencies are and what the changes are. If you haven't done this, it'll be okay to do it again. It'll be more than okay to do it again. If you haven't done it, you'll see. Okay, so it's what I call the chakra gram. How many of you have done this with me before?
I have.
Chakra gram. Okay, so 30%, okay? I will lead you through it next week. Pretty interesting experience. In 2 weeks, Those of you who were in the class this fall, we had, at one class, we had three guests come, Nikki Doner Sherwood, Pamela Grant, and Dr. Stephen Jose, leading us through a few movements of the Qigong of unconditional love. Well, it turns out that teacher Li Junfeng is in Santa Barbara at present, and he's going to come to class in 2 weeks himself and lead us through a whole lot of Qigong of unconditional love. Yeah, that's really happened. And of course, the other three will come with him. So in 2 weeks, we'll be Qigong of unconditional love. And then in 3 weeks, those of you who were here in the fall, what we did for 4 of the 8 classes is we looked in great detail at Stan Grof's view of pre- and perinatal psychology. That is the influence of pre- and perinatal events, that is birth, gestation and birth, on subsequent personality. And the question came up at several points, well, is there evidence for this? This is very compelling, but what is there clinical evidence for this? Is there experimental evidence for this? To what extent is it really true that gestation and birth form personality and influence subsequent life events? And it's pretty hard to do research on this, you know. you can't assign some kids to this kind of gestation and other kids to that kind, but clinically, there are some anecdotes, and the question is, who would know this? So I thought, no one would know this? Marty Glenn would know this, if anybody in Santa Barbara, and maybe in the world, because she started the Santa Barbara Graduate Institute, which was the only place in the country, maybe in the world, which explicitly has its focus pre- and perinatal psychology. So I called Marty Glenn up and said, Marty, would you come to class and talk to the issue of what difference your gestation and birth make for your subsequent life? And she said, sure. So to the extent that there is evidence, we could ask Marty. She's going to come in 3 weeks. Okay? That's what's going to happen. Next week, chakragram experience. In 2 weeks, another experience, the Qigong of unconditional love. And in 3 weeks, Marty Glenn talks to us about pre- and perinatal psychology. Okay. Art. If you bring your art in, either spoken art or visual art or any other kind of art you want to bring in, at the end of class, at 11:30, anybody who wants to leave, leaves, and then the people that want to stay for a few minutes, we present our art to one another. This is a great forum. I encourage you to do that. Typically, we have about half the class, at least, stay. There is one piece of art right there now that is next to the table that you signed in on. Whose piece of art is that? Carl, say something about it right now so people can look at it.
Well, it's a oil painting from my last semester of painting, which was my second semester, and from the middle of the semester. It's a still life painting of two gourds I guess, of bronze. The sculpture project, and then I painted them.
But this is the poly talent Carl Blasius. He was a sculptor last time I met him.
Still taking sculptures, but yeah, that was based on, I was painting a still life of my own.
Of your sculpture. Ah, okay, so you
might want to take it. I brought the bronze gourds in for people to see in the past.
All right, so again, starting next week, please bring your art in. Thank you, Carl. Donna, why don't you talk about life stories just a bit?
In the last couple of years, we have gathered life stories of participants in the class. Basically, it's a page or two about autobiography or about some anecdote that was important to you. Gathered in a notebook, and they're also on our website. This is available for you to take. Take it, just bring it back to them later so you can see what other people have done. And that's it.
Donna will have more to say about this in the future. We're actually going to kind of encourage you to add your voice to the symphony here, or to the chorus. And we'll probably have a structured way for you to do that if you need structure. No, my new one, we purged the old ones, right?
We have.
So, no, I haven't written the new one yet. So I'm waiting for Donna to kick me in the butt. That's it. But it'll be there. Peter.
Peter Wright, and I'm part of the planning group for the upcoming, for the Santa Barbara chapter of the International Association of Near-Death Studies. And Kevin Alexander, who wrote Proof of Heaven, will be coming to Santa Barbara again this week from Saturday night at the Marjorie Luke Theater. And so we invite you to come and hear him speak. His book was on the bestseller list for 59 weeks for the New York Times. And he'll be doing talking about his experience of heaven, and more information will be coming in this presentation than there was the last time. So there are flyers over there on the desk next to the art. And then secondly, I gave a presentation last semester on past life regression, and mentioned in that presentation that I was giving a workshop on clear lifetimes of karma with the help of Lady Master Kuan Yin and the Ascended Masters. I'll be giving this workshop again a week from next Wednesday at the Center of the Heart in Santa Barbara. So there are flyers over there that talk about that as well. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. This is Peter Wright, and many of you know Peter and his work.
Thank you.
Let's see. One more thing before we do what we're going to do, which is, Robert, is it true that our class, that recordings of the class are still available on swt.org/Spencer? swt.org/Spencer. This is Robert Bernstein's website, part of it that he has made available to the class. So if you go there, you can listen to past classes. And if you miss a class this time, we will occasionally what's the latency between a class and when it gets up?
One week.
Okay, so Michael Agnewald is our audio guy. And
recording today.
Okay, so Michael's recording every utterance you make. And it will be forever.
Right.
Remember, immortalized, so be careful what you say. On swt.org/Spencer.
Is that where the our personal memoirs are located to?
Yeah. I put those up.
So they're also up there, and they will, as they come in, they will be added.
And then they're up there for all eternity.
Right.
Oh, God.
All right. So here's what we're going to do now. Okay. First of all, it's an experiment because we're going to see how well the system works, because we're going to be using this a lot. There's a lot of internet resources I want to show you. So what that will mean is we'll close everything we can close, which is two layers of drapes, and maybe even the stuff up there if we can figure out how to do it.
This is really good over here.
And then what I'm going to show you is, I'll wait for you guys to do that. I'll show you.
It's been systems to me. It's kind of blocking.
Yeah. All right. So that's good. And yeah, those guys are close to me.
That's true.
All right. But I want to start as possible. And if you're too far back and want to move your chairs up to closer to the front, you're welcome to do that. And I'll tell you what this is that we're going to see.
The light behind the screen?
I have no idea how to do that, but we got to do that.
Where's the projector?
The projector is behind the screen. Let me see if I can get this light.
Yay! Very good.
How about that? All right, so what we've got here is... The title of this class is The Minds of Babes. We have looked at gestation and birth. I thought the natural progression would be to look at some leading-edge research in what happens in infants' minds as consciousness develops. what's happened in developmental psychology used to be kind of a peripheral area in psychology, kind of a bunch of people looking at kids playing on the playground and trying to figure out kind of who they were from how they played. It's kind of evolved quickly, and developmental psychology is an incredibly compelling area right now in psychology, because we have all kinds of new tools to ascertain how consciousness is developing in very young children. And it tells us what consciousness is, and also gives us a hint about how to intervene when development is not proceeding well, and also how to change consciousness in adults because we understand better how it is formed. So developmental psychology is really compelling right now, and you're going to see two of the world's best developmental psychologists talking about leading-edge research, and it's going to have implications not only for how children develop consciousness, but also for how your consciousness can be improved. How we can learn from what children do well that we no longer do well.
The question is how I'm going to, let's see about the audio here. I'm not sure about the audio, but I'm going to presume it's going to be okay. If not, we're going to go. Could you hear?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's go a little bit lower then. Yeah. So we'll close ourselves out and see what happens, okay? All right. So Alison Gopnik is a professor of psychology and philosophy at Berkeley.
Baby's mind. If you'd asked people this 30 years ago, most people, including psychologists, would have said that this baby was irrational, illogical, egocentric, that he couldn't take the perspective of another person or understand cause and effect. In the last 20 years, developmental science has completely overturned that picture. So, in some ways, we think that this baby's thinking is like the thinking of the most brilliant scientists. Let me give you just one example of this. One thing that this baby could be thinking about, that could be going on in his mind, is trying to figure out what's going on in the mind of that other baby. After all, one of the things that's hardest for all of us to do is to figure out what other people are thinking and feeling. And maybe the hardest thing of all is to figure out that what other people think and feel isn't actually exactly like what we think and feel. Anyone who's followed politics can testify to how hard that is for some people to get. We wanted to know if babies and young children could understand this really profound thing about other people. Now, the question is, how could we ask them? Babies, after all, can't talk, and if you ask a three-year-old to tell you what he thinks, what you'll get is a beautiful stream of consciousness monologue about ponies and birthdays and things like that. So how can we actually ask them the question? Well, it turns out that the secret was broccoli. What we did, Betty Rapicoli was one of my students and I, was actually to give the babies two bowls of food, one bowl of raw broccoli and one bowl of delicious goldfish crackers. Now, all of the babies, even in Berkeley, like the crackers and don't like the raw broccoli. But then, what Betty did was to take a little taste of food from each bowl, and she would act as if she liked it or she didn't. So half the time, she acted as if she liked the crackers and didn't like the broccoli, just like the baby and any other sane person. But half the time, what she would do is take a little bit of the broccoli and go, broccoli! I tasted the broccoli! And then she would take a little bit of the crackers and she'd go, oh, yuck! Crackers! I tasted the crackers. Ooh, yuck! So she acted as if what she wanted was just the opposite of what the babies wanted. We did this with 15 and 18 month old babies. And then she would simply put her hand out and say, can you give me some? So the question is, what would the baby give her? What they liked or what she liked? And the remarkable thing was that 18-month-old babies, just barely walking and talking, would give her the crackers if she liked the crackers, but they would give her the broccoli if she liked the broccoli. On the other hand, 15-month-olds would stare at her for a long time if she acted as if she liked the broccoli. Like they couldn't figure this out. But then after they stared for a long time, they would just give her the crackers, what they thought everybody must like. So there are two really remarkable things about this. The first one is that these little 18-month-old babies have already discovered this really profound fact about human nature, that we don't always want the same thing. And what's more, they felt that they should actually do things to help other people get what they wanted. Even more remarkably, though, the fact that the 15-month-olds didn't do this suggests that these 18-month-olds hadn't learned this deep, profound fact about human nature in the 3 months from the time they were 15 months old. So children both know more and learn more than we ever would have thought. And this is just one of hundreds and hundreds of studies over the last 20 years that's actually demonstrated this. The question you might ask, though, is why do children learn so much, and how is it possible for them to learn so much in such a short time? I mean, after all, if you look at babies superficially, they seem pretty useless. And actually, in many ways, they're worse than useless because we have to put so much time and energy into just keeping them alive. But if we turn to evolution for an answer to this puzzle of why we spend so much time taking care of useless babies, it turns out that there's actually an answer. If we look across many, many different species of animals, not just us primates, but also including other mammals, birds, even marsupials like kangaroos and wombats, it turns out that there's a relationship between how long a childhood a species has and how big their brains are compared to their bodies and how smart and flexible they are. And sort of the poster birds for this idea are the birds up there. On one side is a New Caledonian crow. And crows and other corvids, ravens, rooks, and so forth are incredibly smart birds. They're as smart as chimpanzees in some respects. And this is a bird on the cover of Science who's learned how to use a tool to get food. On the other hand, we have our friend the domestic chicken. And chickens and ducks and geese and turkeys are basically as dumb as stumps. So they're very, very good at pecking for grain, and they're not much good at doing anything else. Well, it turns out that the babies, the New Caledonian crow babies, are fledglings. They depend on their moms to drop worms in their little open mouths for as long as 2 years, which is a really long time in the life of a bird, whereas the chickens are actually mature within a couple of months. So, childhood is the reason why the crows end up on the cover of Science and the chickens end up in the soup pot. There's something about that long childhood that seems to be connected to knowledge and learning. Well, what kind of explanation can we have for this? Well, some animals, like the chicken, seem to be beautifully suited to doing just one thing very well. So they seem to be beautifully suited to pecking grain in one environment. Other creatures, like the crows, aren't very good at doing anything in particular, but they're extremely good at learning about lots of different environments. And of course, we human beings are way out on the end of the distribution like the crows. We have bigger brains relative to our bodies by far than any other animal. We're smarter, we're more flexible, we can learn more, we survive in more different environments, we've migrated to cover the world and even go to outer space. And our babies and children are dependent on us for much longer than the babies of any other species. My son is 23, and at least until they're 23, we're still popping those worms into the mouths. All right, why would we see this correlation? Well, an idea is that that strategy, that learning strategy, is an extremely powerful, great strategy for getting on in the world, but it has one big disadvantage. And that one big disadvantage is that until you actually do all that learning, you're going to be helpless. So you don't want to have the mastodon charging at you and be saying to yourself, a slingshot or maybe a spear might work, which would actually be better. You want to know all that before the mastodons actually show up. And the way that evolution seems to have solved that problem is with the kind of division of labor. So the idea is that we have this early period when we're completely protected, we don't have to do anything, all we have to do is learn. And then as adults, we can take all those things that we learned when we were babies and children and actually put them to work to do things out there in the world. So one way of thinking about it is that babies and young children are like the research and development division of the human species. So they're the protected blue sky guys who just have to go out and learn and have good ideas, and we're production and marketing. We have to take all those ideas that we learned when we were children and actually put them to use. Another way of thinking about it is instead of thinking about babies and children as being like defective grown-ups, we should think about them as being a different developmental stage of the same species, kind of like caterpillars and butterflies, except that they're actually the brilliant butterflies who are flitting around the garden and exploring, and we're the caterpillars who are inching along our narrow grown-up adult path. If this is true, if these babies are designed to learn, and this evolutionary story would say children are for learning, that's what they're for, we might expect that they would have really powerful learning mechanisms. And in fact, the baby's brain seems to be the most powerful learning computer on the planet. But real computers are actually getting to be a lot better. And there's been a revolution in our understanding of machine learning recently, and it all depends on the ideas of this guy, the Reverend Thomas Bayes, who was a statistician and mathematician in the 18th century. And essentially what Bayes did was to provide a mathematical way, using probability theory, to characterize, to describe the way that scientists find out about the world. So what scientists do is they have a hypothesis that they think might be likely to start with. They go out and test it against the evidence makes them change that hypothesis, then they test that new hypothesis, and so on and so forth. And what Bayes showed was a mathematical way that you could do that. And that mathematics is at the core of the best machine learning programs that we have now. And some 10 years ago, I suggested that babies might be doing the same thing. So if you want to know what's going on underneath those beautiful brown eyes, I think it actually looks something like this. This is Reverend Bayes' notebook. So I think those babies are actually making complicated calculations with conditional probabilities that they're revising to figure out how the world works. All right, now that might seem like an even taller order to actually demonstrate, because after all, if you ask even grown-ups about statistics, they look extremely stupid. How could it be that children are doing statistics? So to test this, we used a machine that we have called the Blicket Detector. This is a box that lights up and plays music when you put some things on it and not others. And using this very simple machine, my lab and others have done dozens of studies showing just how good babies are at learning about the world. Let me mention just one that we did with Tamara Kushner, my student. If I showed you this detector, you would be likely to think, to begin with, that the way to make the detector go would be to put a block on top of the detector. But actually, this detector works in a bit of a strange way. Because if you wave a block over the top of the detector, something you would never think of to begin with, the detector will actually activate 2 out of 3 times. Whereas if you do the likely thing, put the block on the detector, it will only activate 2 out of 6 times. So the unlikely hypothesis actually has stronger evidence. It looks as if the waving is a more effective strategy than the other strategy. So we did just this. We gave 4-year-olds this pattern of evidence, and we just asked them to make it go. And sure enough, the 4-year-olds used the evidence to wave the object on top of the detector. Now, there are 2 things that are really interesting about this. The first one is, again, remember, these are 4-year-olds. They're just learning how to count. But unconsciously, they're doing these quite complicated calculations that will give them a conditional probability measure. And the other interesting thing is that they're using that evidence to get to an idea, get to a hypothesis about the world that seems very unlikely to begin with. And in studies we've just been doing in my lab, similar studies, we've shown that 4-year-olds are actually better at finding out an unlikely hypothesis than adults are when you give them exactly the same test. So in these circumstances, the children are using statistics to find out about the world, but after all, scientists also do experiments. And we wanted to see if children are doing experiments. When children do experiments, we call it getting into everything, or else playing. And there's been a bunch of interesting studies recently that have shown that this playing around is really a kind of experimental research program. Here's one from Christine Legaris. What Christine did was use our lipid detectors, and what she did was show children that yellow ones made it go and red ones didn't, and then she showed them an anomaly. And what you'll see is that this little boy will go through 5 hypotheses in the space of 2 minutes. Okay, so he's just, his first hypothesis has just been falsified.
Nothing. This one's light up, and this one's not.
Okay, you guys, it's fair enough to go out. Recognize that expression of despair, right?
Oh, it's because this is to be like this, and this is to be like this.
Okay, I thought this is two.
That's
not. Oh. Now this is his next idea. He tells the experiment to do this, to try putting it out over onto the other location. Not working out.
Oh, because the light goes only to here, not here. Oh, the bottom of this box has electricity in here, but this doesn't have electricity.
Okay, that's the fourth hypothesis.
It's lighting up! So we need to put 4. So we need to put 4 on this one to make it light up, and 2 on this one to make it light up.
Okay, there's the fifth hypothesis. Now that is a particularly adorable and articulate little boy. But what Christine discovered is this is actually quite typical. If you look at the way children play, when you ask them to explain something, what they really do is do a series of experiments. This is actually pretty typical of 4-year-olds. Well, what's it like to be this kind of creature? What's it like to be one of these brilliant butterflies who can task 5 hypotheses in 2 minutes? Well, if you go back to the psychologists and philosophers, a lot of them had said that babies and young children were barely conscious if they were conscious at all. And I think just the opposite is true. I think babies and children are actually more conscious than they are as adults. Now, here's what we know about how adult consciousness works. And adult attention and consciousness look kind of like a spotlight. So what happens for adults is we decide that something's relevant or important, we should pay attention to it. Our consciousness of that thing that we're attending to becomes extremely bright and vivid, and everything else sort of goes dark. And we even know something about the brain, the way the brain does this. So what happens when we pay attention is that the prefrontal cortex, the sort of executive part of our brain, sends a signal that makes a little part of our brain much more flexible, more plastic, better at learning, and shuts down activity in all the rest of our brains. So we have a very focused, purpose-driven kind of attention. If we look at babies and young children, we see something very different. I think babies and young children seem to have more of a lantern of consciousness than a spotlight of consciousness. So babies and young children are very bad at narrowing down to just one thing, but they're very good at taking in lots of information from lots of different sources at once. And if you actually look in their brains, you see that they're flooded with these neurotransmitters that are really good at inducing learning and plasticity, and the inhibitory parts haven't come on yet. So when we say that babies and young children are bad at paying attention, what we really mean is that they're bad at not paying attention. So they're bad at getting rid of all the interesting things that could tell them something and just looking at the thing that's important. That's the kind of attention, the kind of consciousness that we might expect from those butterflies who are designed to learn. Well, if we want to think about a way of getting a taste of that kind of baby consciousness as adults, I think the best thing is think about cases where we're put in a new situation that we've never been in before. When we fall in love with someone new, or when we're in a new city for the first time. And what happens then is not that our consciousness contracts, it expands. so that those 3 days in Paris seem to be more full of consciousness and experience than all the months of being a walking, talking, faculty meeting attending zombie back home. And by the way, that coffee, that wonderful coffee you've been drinking downstairs, actually mimics the effect of those baby neurotransmitters. So, what's it like to be a baby? It's like being in love in Paris for the first time after you've had three double espresso. Waking up crying at 3 o'clock in the morning. Now, it's good to be a grown-up. I don't want to say too much about how wonderful babies are. It's good to be a grown-up. We can do things like tie our shoelaces and cross the street by ourselves. And it makes sense that we put a lot of effort into actually making babies think like adults do. But if what we want is to be like those butterflies, to have open-mindedness, open learning, imagination, creativity, innovation, maybe at least some of the time, we should be getting the adults to start thinking more like children.
For a minute, I got to put a light on her too. I'm going to put a light on her too if I can figure it out. There we go. I just want to talk a tiny bit about this in a couple minutes. There's a lot of stuff I could say about this. So I'm not going to get it all, but when she did the diagnosis, let's go from the, I got to organize my thoughts a little bit. The diagram of adult consciousness being like a spotlight and focusing on the correct answer, and the child's consciousness being like going all over the place.
Lantern.
She called it a lantern.
Okay.
The going all over the place is called divergent thinking. And the focusing in is called convergent thinking. And it's not only that children go look at all kinds of aspects of the thing, it's that there's a gender difference. Women tend to be better at divergent thinking. They include more aspects in their thought. They consider more possibilities. Men tend to be better at convergent thinking, that is, coming to the one correct answer. This supposedly has evolutionary roots. It was men's job in the hunter-gatherer days to focus on the prey and ignore everything else, or focus on the threat and ignore everything else. It was women's job to pay attention to the kids who are all the heck over the place, and to find the berries over here and the fruit over here. And so women evolved a wider point of view, if you will. And we actually find that neurophysiologically, that women have better peripheral vision than men. It's still the case. Another way to look at this is men tend to be, as you know, men tend to be more left hemisphere and women tend to be more balanced in the use of the two cerebral hemispheres. The left hemisphere is the proceed to the correct answer by eliminating all other possibilities part, the linear thinker. The right hemisphere tends to be more holistic and pull in more aspects. Creativity seems to be a more right hemisphere than left hemisphere function, which is interesting. It may be that as women's place in society changes toward being more empowered, that we will find more and more of the creative contributions coming from women, even in things like science. Also, when you think about school, you take children who are divergent, creative, innovative thinkers who generate a lot of hypotheses and gather a lot of statistics, and you make them into you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, that's stupid, that's ridiculous, get the correct answer. So you make them into convergent thinkers who are more routinized in their thinking, less likely to see possibilities. Those of you who know Ken Robinson talks a lot about this. He's famous for talking about the fact that school does exactly the wrong thing. So what she's suggesting for us is we need to open our minds
and not be sure of our view of the world that we exclude other possibilities. That's easier said than done, but that's obviously the prescription. Statistics, one more thing, and then I got to show you the other one. Statistics. Babies gathering statistics. You saw that kid? That kid went, maybe it's like this. Doesn't work. Oh, maybe it's like this. Maybe it's like this. That kid, I would have done the same damn thing over and over again. Why the hell doesn't it work like this? Why does it work like this? You know, we get it's called functional fixity of motives. We kind of get narrowed into one idea of what works for what. And we don't see the possibilities. Kids are better at seeing all kinds of other possibilities. And one more thing, statistics. The first thing she said about putting the thing on the box to make it light up, or waving the thing over the box to make it light up, what the little kids are doing is they're putting the thing on it, they're seeing how often it lights up, two out of every six times, and they're waving it on top and they're seeing how often it lights up, two out of every three times. And they're just like playing around, and they're gathering. You know, when I do this, does it work? When I do this, does it work? When I do this, does it work? And they're kind of gathering statistics on all the possibilities and how frequently those possibilities create positive outcome, create success. And we just tend to wonder why our possibility doesn't create success. So Abraham, you want to say, and then I've got to show you something else.
Kids also tend to learn languages, new languages, faster than
That's the segue.
Sometimes when I learn a new language, I wish I was a kid.
That's the segue. Perfect. You know, we're all one mind here, I swear. Once you meditate together, he just made the perfect segue to the next thing that I want to show you, okay? You'll see. That was an absolutely perfect comment. So here we go. One more. This is a brief one. This is 11 minutes. Or 10 and a half minutes. This woman is a professor at the University of Washington. Okay. And her name is... Bear with the first part of her talk. It's good, but the last part of her talk is spectacular. You'll see.
Spelled her name wrong.
Oh, that's why, because
Patricia.
Patricia. Yeah, that's the one. Thank you.
No.
I thought it gave me the correct answer. Come on.
You put four blocks on it.
That's yes.
What's going on up in that little brain of hers? The modern tools of neuroscience are demonstrating to us that what's going on up there is nothing short of rocket science. And what we're learning is going to shed some light on what the romantic writers and poets describe as the celestial openness of the child's mind. What we see here is a mother in India, and she's speaking Koro, which is a newly discovered language. And she's talking to her baby. What this mother and the 800 people who speak Koro in the world understand that to preserve this language, they need to speak it to the babies. And therein lies a critical puzzle. Why is it that you can't preserve a language by speaking to you and I, to the adults? Well, it's got to do with your brain. What we see here is that language has a critical period for learning. The way to read this slide is to look at your age on the horizontal axis. And you'll see on the vertical your skill at acquiring a second language. The babies and children are geniuses until they turn 7, and then there's a systematic decline. After puberty, we fall off the map. No scientists dispute this curve, but laboratories all over the world are trying to figure out why it works this way. Work in my lab is focused on the first critical period in development, and that is the period in which babies try to master which sounds are used in their language. We think by studying how the sounds are learned, we'll have a model for the rest of language, and perhaps for critical periods that may exist in childhood for social, emotional, and cognitive development. So we've been studying the babies using a technique that we're using all over the world in the sounds of all languages. The baby sits on a parent's lap, and we train them to turn their heads when a sound changes, like from ah to e. If they do so at the appropriate time, the black box lights up, and a panda bear pounds a drum. A six-monther adores the task. What have we learned? Well, babies all over the world are what I like to describe as citizens of the world. They can discriminate all the sounds of all languages, no matter what country we're testing and what language we're using. And that's remarkable because you and I can't do that. We're culture-bound listeners. We can discriminate the sounds of our own language, but not those of foreign languages. So the question arises, when do those citizens of the world turn into the language-bound listeners that we are? And the answer? Before their first birthdays. What you see here is performance on that head-turn task. For babies tested in Tokyo and in the United States, here in Seattle, as they listen to ra and la, sounds important to English, but not to Japanese. So at 6 to 8 months, the babies are totally equivalent. 2 months later, something incredible occurs. The babies in the United States are getting a lot better. The babies in Japan are getting a lot worse. But both of those groups of babies are preparing for exactly the language that they're going to learn. So the question is, what's happening during this critical two-month period? This is the critical period for sound development, but what's going on up there? So there are two things going on. The first is that the babies are listening intently to us, and they're taking statistics as they listen to us talk. They're taking statistics. So listen to two mothers speaking motherese, the universal language we use when we talk to kids, first in English and then in Japanese.
Ah, I love your big blue eyes. So pretty and nice.
During the production of speech, when babies listen, what they're doing is taking statistics on the language that they hear. And those distributions grow. And what we've learned is that babies are sensitive to the statistics, and the statistics of Japanese and English are very, very different. English has a lot of R's and L's, the distribution shows, and the distribution of Japanese is totally different, where we see a group of intermediate sounds, which is known as the Japanese R. So babies absorb the statistics of the language, and it changes their brains. It changes them from the citizens of the world to the culture-bound listeners that we are. But we as adults are known...
I want to show you that again, just to make sure, because that's critical. Let's go back there. Okay, so what the babies are listening to their mothers, and they're getting better at distinguishing the sounds that they hear frequently. So the English hearing babies are hearing a lot of English R's and L's. See, that's the number of times they're hearing those things. And because they're hearing those things frequently, they're tuning their auditory apparatus to be able to hear those things well. And they're not hearing the Japanese intermediate R very much at all, and so they're losing the ability to hear that. The Japanese children are not hearing English R's and L's very much, so they're losing the ability to distinguish those sounds, and they're getting better at the ability to distinguish the Japanese R. They're just listening, and what they hear frequently, they're wiring in. Ah, pay attention to that. Ah, get good at that. Other one, I'm not using that pathway, goes away.
see a group of intermediate sounds, which is known as the Japanese bar. So babies absorb the statistics of the language, and it changes their brains. It changes them from the citizens of the world to the culture-bound listeners that we are. But we as adults are no longer absorbing those statistics. We're governed by the representations in memory that were formed early in development. So what we're seeing here is changing our models of what the critical period is about. We're arguing from a mathematical standpoint that the learning of language material may slow down when our distributions stabilize. It's raising lots of questions about bilingual people. Bilinguals must keep two sets of statistics in mind at once and flip between them, one after the other, depending on who they're speaking to. So we asked ourselves, can the babies take statistics on a brand new language? And we tested this by exposing American babies who've never heard a second language to Mandarin for the first time during the critical period. We knew that when monolinguals were tested in Taipei and Seattle on the Mandarin sounds, they showed the same pattern. 6 to 8 months, they're totally equivalent. 2 months later, something incredible happens. But the Taiwanese babies are getting better, not the American babies. What we did was expose American babies during this period to Mandarin. It was like having Mandarin relatives come and visit for a month and move into your house and talk to the babies for 12 sessions. Here's what it looked like in the laboratory. So what have we done to their little brains? We had to run a control group to make sure that just coming into the laboratory didn't improve your Mandarin skills. So a group of babies came in and listened to English, and we can see from the graph that exposure to English didn't improve their Mandarin. But look what happened to the babies exposed to Mandarin for 12 sessions. They were as good as the babies in Taiwan who'd been listening for 10 and a half months. What it demonstrated is that they...
Okay, so that's incredible. Just 12 practice sessions, and their brain was tuned up to be able to hear those sounds as well as if they heard those sounds from birth. So babies are genius language learners in terms of how their brain is wired. We're obviously not. I mean...
take statistics on a new language. Whatever you put in front of them, they'll take statistics on. But we wondered what role the human being played in this learning exercise. So we ran another group of babies in which the kids were get the same dosage, the same 12 sessions, but over a television set. And another group of babies who had just audio exposure and looked at a teddy bear on the screen. What did we do to their brains? What you see here is the audio result, no learning whatsoever, and the video result, no learning whatsoever. It takes a human being for babies to take their statistics.
The question, okay, now this is a big deal. What she just slid through here, I got a comment on. It may not just be babies that we're talking about. So the trend in education right now is MOOCs, right? Is massive open online courses. The idea is everybody is going to watch on their, they don't go to school anymore, they just watch on their computer, they watch the best people in the world lecturing to them, and that's how they learn. So none of us have to listen to me, we can listen to Harvard professors, none of my students have to come to my classes, you know, that kind of thing. The question is that equivalent? Well, the data are kind of a little distressing in that 160,000 people start the MOOC and 5,000 people graduate from it. A lot of dropouts. But there are multiple factors that influence that. But one factor may be that we just don't learn as well from two-dimensional or purely auditory kinds of inputs. So the question is, to what extent throughout our lives
We need actual human interaction in order to have the optimal kind of connection. This goes for huge, this goes for other things than learning subjects. It goes for, is it equivalent to have no friends in flesh and blood and spend no time with flesh and blood people, but go home every night and get on Second Life and drive your Ferrari around and screw around and go in your mansion, you know, all on your computer, all in an imagined way? Is do 100 friends on Facebook equal one flesh and blood friend? And remember what Sherry Turkle said. Probably not. Abraham, now we got to go back to this.
Yeah, what do you think of online universities?
Well, that's what you're talking
about. Are they a tool to learn? According to your...
Okay, a short answer to the question about online universities is for very smart, motivated people, online learning works nicely. But even very smart, motivated people make online communities with other people because it really helps to have a lot of other people to ask, what did that, you know, to kind of dialogue with, even if you can't see them. But for the average student, purely online courses are really challenging and have low completion rates compared to face-to-face courses. Let's keep going.
The social brain is controlling when the babies are taking their statistics. We want to get inside the brain and see this thing happening as babies are in front of televisions as opposed to in front of human beings. Thankfully, we have a new machine, magnetoencephalography, that allows us to do this. It looks like a hairdryer from Mars, but it's completely safe, completely non-invasive, and silent. We're looking at millimeter accuracy with regard to spatial and millisecond accuracy using 306 squids. These are superconducting quantum interference devices to pick up the magnetic fields that change as we do our thinking. We're the first in the world to record babies in an MEG machine while they are learning. So this is little Emma. She's a six-monther, and she's listening to various languages in the earphones that are in her ears. You can see she can move around. We're tracking her head with little pellets in a cap, so she's free to move, completely unconstrained. It's a technical tour de force. What are we seeing? We're seeing the baby brain as the baby hears a word in her language. The auditory areas line up, and then subsequently areas surrounding it that we think are related to coherence, getting the brain coordinated with its different areas, and causality, one brain area causing another to activate. We are embarking on a grand and golden age of knowledge about child's brain development. We're going to be able to see a child's brain.
I think what we can do is we can go like this. This happens occasionally, though it doesn't happen. I'm not sure.
We're now on bars.
Okay, so let's see what we can do.
You can press the re cycle.
Let's play the re button and just put it back to where we want to be. All right, so take a minute. Get back to the audio room.
Child's brain. We're going to uncover deep truths about what it means to be human. And in the process, we may be.
There we go.
And complete openness of the mind of a child.
There we go.
Being able to invent brain-based interventions for children who have difficulty
learning.
Sorry,
I didn't guess the right place. There we go.
To see a child's brain as they experience an emotion, as they learn to speak and read, as they solve a math problem, as they have an idea. And we're going to be able to invent brain-based interventions for children who have difficulty learning. Just as the poets and writers described, we're going to be able to see, I think, that wondrous openness, utter and complete openness of the mind of a child. In investigating the child's brain, we're going to uncover deep truths about what it means to be human. And in the process, we may be able to help keep our own minds open to learning for our entire lives. Thank you.
Okay, so
wait. Okay. I gotta say some stuff about the last thing that she said because it wasn't really clear and I didn't want to keep playing with it. What she said is we're going to be able to see how consciousness develops in various ways in the child as it develops, because we're going to be seeing how the brain wires up. What that's going to lead to is the ability to make therapies that correct development that is not proceeding well. And also, in adults, it may help us evolve therapies to reconstruct inadequate brain constructions. So the learning of how things develop is crucial for our understanding of how they work and how to improve them. What the MEG device that she showed you, I'd never heard about that before. What's happening now in a lot of related fields, psychology and a lot of related fields, is because of new technology, because of new ability to look inside the brain in real time, we're understanding things very swiftly that we couldn't understand before. That is, how things work, how things go wrong, how things can be enhanced. And we're just at the beginning of understanding that. There's just an outpouring of research starting, and it's a tidal wave already, but it's going to be I don't know what you would say, but something incredible. Because every aspect of human experience can now be looked at in terms of what's going on with great accuracy in the brain. And that will transform what we understand and how we can help. Okay. All right, so questions or comments? Let's go. We'll go this way. Michael, and then Morty, and then Chris.
It's important to note that she was talking about natural or spoken language, not artificial, for example, like a computer language. For me, it's so hard to learn natural spoken languages. The computer languages come very, very easily.
different brain processes. Morty, and then Chris, and then we have to get out of here because other folks come in. Morty.
A touch of paranoia, mind control, and all that that contains.
Science in general, technology can be, it's power. It can be used either well or poorly. The power is like atomic power. It's on the earth, it ain't going away. The question is what we're going to do with this new capability. And that's where ethics and scientific morality come in. Chris, and then Anthony.
A French doctor, sound expert, Alfred Tomatis, since the 50s was doing work on how come people lose the ability to learn a new language and what happens. And he went with the hypothesis that it's a form of atrophied brain and hearing, and that an atrophied muscle can be reactivated by the mere stimulation. Yeah. So he invented a helmet that has been used in all his labs around the world for over 30 years, where based on a graph, he graphed every language and noticed which sounds are used and are not used. Then he compared that language to the language that the person grew up with and determined the deficiencies. So if a Japanese wanted to learn English and just couldn't literally hear some of the English sounds, they go to this lab, they get this helmet, and they bombard the brain with the sounds that they have heard their whole life.
Yeah.
After the lab, they go to the English class, and they can perfectly repeat the sounds they hear.
That. Thank you, Chris. We're going to do a whole section on neuroplasticity. On the fact that, in fact, one's brain is not fixed as an adult, and it is possible to retrain a remarkable amount of brain function. Annie, you want to say it? And then we got a break.
Evolution differentiates us all more and more and more and more and more. Culturally, though, the cultural companion to evolution's differentiation is learning interbeing.
Yeah.
with everything, with each other, and intervene. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, there are two things that shape us: our evolutionary history and our cultural surrounding. And what Ani is saying is we're more and more seeing the differences between us evolutionarily, but culturally we're seeing more and more the connection between us, so, and the similarities.
It's mandated to me, survival is mandated, that we develop a culture where we learn the interbeing of all things in our differentiation.
Agreed. Okay, we gotta get out. Len, what do you want to say?